Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
Damian Team.
QNL.
With guest co-hosts.
MSLS.
Emperor Peter.
Locutus.
Alright, we'll do the countdown here. So next time on Go, we'll hit the shiny red record button. Are you ready? Well, yes, Dan, we are.
All okay. All right, yeah. Yes.
Ready.
Ready for cars.
This is number 98. Today we are joined by Dan Q.
You do realize what Sid has done. His games provide hours of fun. I sit here in awe, on floor, sits my jaw. Sid Meier's the greatest, bar none. Credit, bam, bam.
Too long. Did not listen.
Michael Lucas Smith, MSLS.
Hi. There once was a unit from Nantucket who... Oh, wait. Family-friendly show.
Peter Rangers, Emperor Peter.
I noticed some people try too hard for this, so I'm just going to go with hello, everyone.
Wooter Locutus.
Hello, everyone.
And me, Lisa QNL.
Good to have you back there, Locutus. Wooter was a regular co-host in the first season of the show and has been back a couple of times. Also a regular on Modcast these days. That's why he hasn't been around.
You only have me on if you really run out of options, so I know.
There was a comment that I thought was really interesting. Someone was complaining that they gave up on Civilization because no matter how much effort and work they put into my Civilization, it was always Sid Meier's Civilization. Okay. And they were kind of petitioning that Civ 5 should not be Sid Meier's Civilization, but just Civilization 5.
I think the marketers have something to say about that.
I don't know. See, I think the marketers have got their head up their ass because I don't care that it's Sid Meier's Civilization. And I've been there from the start. I played Civ 1, Civ 2, Civ 3, Civ 4. I really like Sid Meier, and I really appreciate the work that he's doing and the game that he made, but, you know...
Yeah, at this point, I think it's just tradition.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think people who buy Civ 5 now think, oh yeah, he used to make these great flight sims.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a major consideration.
Wow, maybe this version will have dinosaurs in it. Yeah.
Civ 1 was a gift from my parents, and I know they didn't buy it because it had Sid Meier's name in it. I know I didn't get Civ 2 because it had Sid Meier's title in it. It's the next Civilization, Civilization 2. I've never actually played any of Sid Meier's older games. Maybe I'm not that old after all. Yes.
You disappoint me, Dan.
What else is new?
Indeed.
The feeling's mutual.
Yeah, Lisa wasn't even born when Sid Meier was around.
Wait a second, am I still placental right now? What's going on?
That's the first use of that term on the show's history. I don't know if that's going to get by the censor, though, Lisa, because...
Because it's vulgar?
No, because it's such a big word. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, okay.
We don't want to be improving people's vocabulary on this show.
Oh, no way. No way, man.
In news, Civilization developer Firaxis Games lays off 20 employees, or perhaps more precisely, 2K.
In the research lab, maybe a new way to expand your empire? Question mark. And UN peacekeepers.
In Form Doc, we talk about farms on hills.
Then under the miscellaneous heading, Dissecting Civilization 5 Special Edition.
Here's what's been making news in the Civ community.
Firaxis laid off, unfortunately, 20 to 30 people, mostly from the quality assurance team, the user interface team, animators, programmers, and designers.
They've been building the game for a while, so maybe they did pick up a whole bunch of people who weren't contributing that much. And it's really hard to tell. But at the same time, maybe I'm wrong, but I vaguely remember this happening right before they released Civ 4. And Civ 4 had lots of bugs, and there are still lots of bugs in Civ 4 even to this day.
I don't remember it happening for Civ 4 myself. We don't know why or who was let go. Don't even know if these guys were for the Civ 5 team. It might be for a different game that they're working on. Do we know anything? I don't think we do.
No, they've been pretty hush-hush about it. So it's possible that they brought on extra people to help them get this title out the door, and they may not have been core to the actual game. So it might all be on the up and up. On the other hand, it could be like Lucas Studios, who made The Force Unleashed and then axed everybody just before they released it.
Marcus Wilding, a global public relations director for 2K, said, quote-unquote, realigned its development resources in order to streamline its development process. Oh,
oh yeah, that is complete and utter bollocks. This, that is awful. I've seen marketing people come in at kind of a semi-high-level position and walk into a conference to sell a product to the community that already uses the product, and they just don't know what they're talking about. That's what this guy reminds me of. It's one of those people who just sort of mouthing gibberish. I think the only key point in his statement that has any relevance is reduce costs.
Yeah.
It could be normal or it could be not normal. I think if it were not normal, we would have heard from the people who had been let go.
Well, they don't usually go very public in this sort of thing. It does happen a lot in the game industry that people let go for all sorts of reasons.
Yeah, I know, but if it was several people who were caught in making this game and they were let go, you would expect that they would be themselves speaking up about it.
I'm not sure that they do. They do have NDAs and stuff like that. Even if you get fired, you can't necessarily talk about what happened. It's rare that that happens. The thing is, we haven't heard anything about this except for the fact that it happened. I don't think we will, so we can really only speculate who they were, what they were doing, were they working on Civ 5, were they working on the MMO that got canned not too long ago. We don't know.
You know what we haven't really heard much about lately is that Facebook Civ Network thing.
Yeah.
And I remember being told that it's going to run from the menu in Civ 5.
Well, what I've understood, it will run inside Civ 5, but yes, Civ 5 has a browser in it. We've been told that, so I assume that's just what they mean. Okay, if you can run any website, yeah, of course you can run Facebook as well. I'm not sure that it will be some way integrated into the game in some unique fashion. I'm not sure that they've said that. But yeah, it could be from Facebook. We haven't heard a lot about the Facebook game in a while. There's supposed to be a beta, an open beta in June, and it's mid-July already, and still hasn't happened. So it is curious to see what happened there.
Right, and Civ 5 is vetted, it's done, right? It's ready to ship. And Civ Network, no news.
Yep, yeah. Don't know if Civ 5 is done, but...
Maybe that's where the 20 came from, is that they weren't getting anything done. Like you said, it's all just pure speculation.
Yeah, exactly.
It is. It seems a little off for it to be either Civilization 5 or Civ Network related, arguably simply because we still have some time until the game is to be released and people are working furiously, at least a number of you are working furiously, in immediate lead up to that. It was mentioned passing there about a canceled project, and we know that Jesse Smith was let go.
Yeah, and it was some time ago. I don't think it was related to this news.
No, it was reported that it was last month, but in fact, anybody can search for Jesse Smith. You can find his LinkedIn page, and he has on there that he ended his time at Firaxis in May.
You know, I actually think it might be related. If you've got a high-level guy who is like the visionary of a project, and he is let go or leaves, then that has a flow-on effect to the people who are working on that project if you can't find somebody suitable to step up and replace them.
Yeah.
In games like this, it's hard to find that guy that really has the right passion and vision to pull it all off.
Yeah, no, it could be that Jesse, I think, I don't know for a fact, but I suspect he was working on this scanned MMO or whatever it was. It could be that the rest of the team, yeah, was let go a month later, but again, we don't really know.
Well, there's 130 people working there, and they let go 20. Some people will be going, oh, that's a lot of people, but it seems fairly reasonable to keep a studio trimmed. 110 people still working on these two core products here, Civ 5 and Civ Network. That's a lot of people. That's not that big of a loss.
If you work for the company, it's a lot of people, I think. You definitely have some friends that have lost their jobs, and that's always a very emotional situation.
I don't see this as sort of like a, okay, we're going to make a whole heap of money off this, let's not have to pay anybody now that we're making money off it, move. As somebody in the comments points out, Barack Obama, the commenter, yeah, great, said when Fallen Earth came out, they dumped 75% of their employees after the release. So that's not this. That's clearly not what they're doing here.
No, of course not.
No, this is not after release.
After or before, it doesn't really make a difference. The point is the game's done and they haven't fired everybody. They just let go a small number of people.
Yeah, okay, but my point was if those people are your friends, it sucks. Or if you're one of them, that's even worse, of course.
I've had people being let go around me before, and what mattered the most was the reason in the company for them being let go. If the company was struggling for money, then you would always be sitting around going, okay, well, who's next? But if it's more along the lines of, okay, well, these people weren't really contributing enough to what we're trying to do here, or that project's gone now, as we've kind of alluded to, then you can rationalize it a lot more easily. And yeah, it sucks. And you could say, okay, well, we can throw these guys a really good goodbye and hopefully we'll see them again in the future if another project comes along. But it's always the mood in the company that matters a lot more than just the fact that these people were let go.
And they were let go of the elimination of approximately 20 positions, quote unquote, is what Welding is saying. So it's not that these people were fired, it's that their positions no longer exist. So it is personal in that, hey, my position is gone, but it wasn't related to their performance. It could just very well be, as we've said, that whatever project number 3 was is no longer around. We know Civ Network is still around, and Civ 5 is around. I mean, 2K confirmed that. Not that we needed that so much for Civ 5. We know from what John Schaefer said in an interview that the Civ 5 team is 52, so if we want to assume that the 20 that were let go were part of this third project, who knows, because then that would leave a little more than that same number of people working on Civ Network, or whatever the abbreviation for Civilization Network is going to be. Some people have said CivNet, but that was an expansion for Civ 1.
Yeah.
Don't say CivNet.
No, exactly.
People who do not know their Civ history call it CivNet, and I will point it out.
Old farts like us will get pissed off if you do.
That's exactly right. Because nobody wants to talk about CivNet. So.
This could be the redeeming quality of CivNet, though, because I never liked CivNet, so this could be a good CivNet.
You want history to be rewritten and have this CivNet overwrite the other one?
Yeah.
I like that in one respect.
That's what civilization's all about.
I'm afraid my integrity is just a little higher than yours, Michael. I can't accept that. Come on into the research lab where we explore concepts that are not in Civ yet, but maybe in the future.
A new way to expand your empire other than with military units. Shadow Badass thinks this would encourage expansion, and he suggests maybe even have priest cities already sprinkled around. It looks like it's going to be that way in Civ 5, I understand, with city-states, but anyway. You start with your capital and you go around and tell the people to join your civilization and you will protect them in exchange. If you protect them long enough, they could join your civilization permanently, I suppose. And this could also be a way to increase your military without spending too much production or money on it. I thought this was kind of a good suggestion because the way that wars are in Civ 4, I think it's very strict. It's either a formal declaration of war or peace. And in real life, this isn't always the case. Especially if you go back in time, wars were kind of fought more loosely, and I don't think the Romans ever declared war on the Celts, for example. Someone started going on conquest, and it wasn't like in Civ 4. So I think this could be good for a more dynamic game.
I don't know about that not declaring war on the Celts thing. I'm not sure if they necessarily sent a messenger to the Celts to tell them, but certainly in Republic and then in the Empire times, they had the Senate, and this stuff was declared before they went off, because it was a great honor for the general to go out there and claim victory and come back and be rewarded. I know, that seems like a declaration to me. I agree with your evaluation that this sounds a lot like what we're going to have in Civ 5, that there are city-states out there that you can carry for their favor and that expansion borders. But I personally never needed much of an encouragement to expand my borders in Civ 4 or any other Civ. I just keep expanding till I can't afford to not.
Well, if you take a more recent example, in World War II in 1940, the German U-boats did sink American ships that were bringing supplies to England.
Yeah, but that's sort of privateer action in many respects. The American ships were smuggling supplies to their enemy, and it was a calculated risk to attack those ships. I like the idea that skirmishes should be able to happen without starting the war.
Yeah, but flying iron to your enemy in Civ 4, you can't do anything about it.
You can go to war with them, which is what happened in World War II.
What I'm not clear about is what this guy actually means by protecting another Civ. I'm not sure how you can protect another Civ without having like a certain number of immediate units to begin with. And by certain number, I mean large number.
I think he's just talking about having your military presence in whatever city that happens to be. Not your city, at least at the start, but saying, we will protect you. And then over, I don't think he mentions a specific number of turns, but whatever, after X number of turns, then that Civ, feeling protected and secure, forms an allegiance towards you and then joins your civilization as a new city.
Yeah, I mean, there's really an interesting puzzle here, is that imagine, if you will, you meet a big empire and they say, hey, do you want to open borders? We can trade. And you go, hey, that sounds great. And then the first thing they do is move 100 military garrisons into your city because the borders are open. How are you meant to interpret that? That's an occupation.
It could be like the U.S. military having lots of bases all over the world, right? Yeah, in Okinawa and DMZ and everything. But anyway.
Just Japan, Afghanistan, Iraq, all places where they're such good friends.
Yeah, those too. Frankfurt and, yeah, I'm sorry, I'm very Asia-centric or something.
No, but these are all places that they basically conquered, so.
That's true. I feel like it's subject to a lot of abuse. Like, you could just take a stack of 100 units, Kamisawa said, and just move them from city to city and overwhelm whatever garrison forces were already there in terms of influence, because I expect that it would be governed by some sort of percentage dynamic plus whatever number of units you have, maybe plus, like, their strength or something. But at least in Civ 4, this could just best be achieved by, like, an improvement of the peace wrestling mechanic, which, yeah, we all have complaints about, right?
I think Shadow Badass is not getting at a relation that is so equal, like between your civilization and another civilization. You're talking about a city that is not formally aligned to any political structure. They're not part of the American civilization or the Chinese civilization, for instance. They're just there. So open borders, quote-unquote, strictly speaking, doesn't apply because we're not talking about equals in terms of, air quotes, civilizations. They may or may not already have some form of domestic protection, but as a result of, if you choose to protect them, and however we're going to measure that, maybe it should be just more than the fact that you garrison some units in there. Perhaps maybe you actually have to protect them. It could be an interesting expansion of that, actually protect them from an invasion where you yourself may end up going to war with another civilization in order to protect a city or two that's not yours.
Or if you're just protection from barbarians, right?
Yeah, barbarians, yeah.
Think about it. When you're playing multiplayer and you're doing like an allied game and you've got a city that's semi-undefended and a whole bunch of barbarians nearby and one of your friends defends your city from those barbarians, you feel really, really good towards that person. It would be really nice if the same could be true of the AIs. If they did it for you and if you did it for them, then that would actually count towards diplomacy.
Yes, count positively towards diplomacy, obviously, because the thing is, in that situation you're describing, right, then that would be one of their cities, and of course they might not be that pleased if you helped defend their city and then their city revolted to you. I mean, you could say, well, it's their own damn fault. But I think Shadow Badass is talking about those cities, as said, that are not already, quote-unquote, somebody's city, that they have no formal structure. They're just kind of like an advanced hut, as we have seen in Civ 4 so far.
You mean city-states?
Like they're getting at with city-states, yes, and for Civilization 5, yes.
Exactly. I think basically, yeah, this is already in Civ 5, more or less, as city-states. The point I wanted to make here is you want to expand your borders with military units. I think we already have a way to do that.
Yeah.
It works pretty well, too.
Yeah, exactly. This is already in Civ 5, a city-state. So I think, yeah, it's a good idea. We'll see how it works out.
I know, is this just because this guy doesn't like building settlers?
Yeah, apparently.
It's like that topic that we had not that long ago, right? No settler. I think it was a research lab.
Oh, no settler unit, yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I was like, I didn't really like that idea either, so.
Well, I like this idea.
It sort of harkens to colonization as well, where you have existing states and you can build up your relations with those states in different ways. You know, you can go to war with them, conquer them. Or you can trade with them, give them shiny baubles, whatever. And eventually they might join you or be forced to join you. And I think it would be really interesting in gameplay-wise if you've got a city-state that's sort of strategic in your military alignment. You're pouring military units in there to garner culture, and your enemy is pouring actual culture in there with diplomats, gold, resources. Who's going to win that race? And how do you stop them from being able to afford to lavish riches upon them so that you can conquer that state without declaring war? It could be very interesting.
I think if you have barbarians around that will attack you on sight, it might make sense if there are people out there that are neutral or even friendly towards you that you can run into.
Yeah, I wonder if that's what Shadow Badass is getting at here. And yes, I just wanted to say Shadow Badass one more time.
He's a bad donkey. I thought this one was really interesting. Soren Arcane says he would like to see UN peacekeeper units in Civ 5. And I guess we can kind of see where this is going, where the UN can intervene during wars between two civilizations. And somebody else adds to the idea that if you have the United Nations, then you can call a vote to start a military action like this. And civilizations that are in the UN must contribute. Otherwise, they curry bad favor with the UN. So the UN is a sort of a Security Council. One of the things that you don't ever do in Civ 4 with it is much of stopping wars. Usually you use it to not stop wars, which is kind of funny.
Yeah.
I guess what you would be able to do is engage in military action without formally declaring and joining one side of a war. But realistically, you are joining one side of a war. When the UN goes in, they're going in to defend one set of interests in a region.
Well, do these units get like minus 90% strength, though? Because the UN peacekeeping forces tend to be pretty useless.
Right, they're more like security to defend aid rather than to keep the peace.
Yeah, tell that to the people of Srebrenica.
I didn't say they'd do it well.
Exactly, that was my point.
But you could definitely see this idea of the UN backing one particular civilization, saying we're going to gift you 10 units each and label them peacekeepers. Which really means they should be labeled war encouragers in that scenario.
Exactly.
The other thing you could do, right, if you feel that you need to help one civilization inside of a war and you want to use the UN to do it instead of doing it alone, you could use the UN to gift money to that nation. That happens all over the world right now in all kinds of situations.
I don't think you should do it like that, Tom. I think the UN should be something like a semi-civilization where it only has an army. The troops in the army come from the members of the UN, so every member donates a number of troops if they need them. It's a civ, but it doesn't have any territory. The army just goes where the fighting is or something like that.
So a city could make like a special like UN peacekeeping unit, the UN peacekeeping marine or something like that.
So would it be like the French Foreign Legion then, I guess? Goes in there and starts fighting on somebody's side.
I think the biggest issue with this is the UN tends to be dominated by the civs that are already very big, so it's just making the big civs even bigger and even stronger. It's kind of a hard puzzle to solve from a game balance point of view.
Well, who would control the unit? That's the big problem for me, is that if everybody's contributing units to this force, and we know that the force is never going to be useful unless it's controlled by people, you can't really have everybody continue to control the units that they added to the force, because there would be no contention there. It would just be crazy. They'd go everywhere.
Well, the UN doesn't really work well in the real world, so I suppose it should be done differently in the game. Actually helps there.
You could have it so that if that was implemented, those units could only be on the defensive. In Civ 4, you've got machine guns units, for example, that are only on the defensive. So that would avoid that potential to then turn around those gifted units and turn them into something offensive.
Well, so that's interesting. So it's sort of the idea is to stalemate a war by bolstering every city's defenses with peacekeeping units, essentially.
Yeah, that could end up being the end result.
And the other thing about that is if you pour a whole bunch of peacekeeper units gifted from around the world from the UN into a city, and then the invading force takes that city, it's not just their city that's being lost. It's all of the units gifted from all those nations around the world. And that should have a fairly negative impact on diplomacy.
Diplomacy with whom, though?
If I gifted 10 highly trained units to the peacekeeping force and then lost them because this giant nation was invading and they didn't take the hint, at that point, I might take matters more in my own hands and declare war. Basically, an atrocity has just occurred.
Kind of a thin blue line before a more global conflict.
Right. It's like, take the hint, dude. All these nations around the world have just tried to defend the city and you've ignored us. So now the gloves are off. We're going to declare war. This is it. Actually, that's one thing that you can't do in Civ 4 is if I put military units into a friend's city and that friend is at war and they get attacked, my units will not defend that city unless I'm also at war. So I think this does fill a gap.
Unless you then in turn gifted your units to that civ.
Yeah, so this would be a way for me to gift units not to a specific civ that they could then turn around and use for something else, like you pointed out, but to this larger peacekeeping force, which over the years would just continue to grow in size and could never be used offensively. I think that's got a lot of merit to it.
One of the primary reasons why the UN doesn't work that well in the real world is that a lot of its resolutions are unenforceable and unenforced. That's not the case in Civilization 4, and I expect not in 5 either. Let's say if the resolution opens borders with everyone, then your borders are automatically open. I still kind of have a problem with this just from game balance perspective. The only current understanding that we have that's something like this right now is probably the Apostolic Palaces go to war with the infidels,
Yeah, and I like your point about the whole enforceability. I think it'd be really neat if the UN and the Apostolic Palace, if you put forward decrees, it didn't enforce them at all, but it told you, I don't know, in a side panel somewhere in Civ 5 terminology, who wasn't following the decree. So that it's up to the players to decide if they feel strongly enough about this to enforce it. And if four of the five civilizations declare that we're not going to build nuclear weapons anymore, and another civilization keeps building them, do they care enough to start a war over it? And I think that's the hard decision that people have to make, not something that should just be automatically enforced or automatically cause war. I think it really should be left to the players to decide.
And the fact that we mentioned this also having some sort of mechanic in the Apostolic Palace, just because it's something that's available earlier on in the game, whereas, of course, the United Nations, in reality, a later concept, at least in practice, if not theory. So to have this as something be more in effect throughout the entire game, since, of course, realism doesn't necessarily translate well into gameplay. Like, how often are we going to see this then, unless we do advanced starts, and regular listeners know what I think of advanced starts.
Actually, it kind of disturbs me, the idea of religiously empowered peacekeeping force.
Well,
that sort of scares me right there.
Not necessarily Apostolic 2.0.
I guess what you might say is that with the Apostolic Palace, any city that has the religion could house said peacekeepers. Or defenders of the faith, I guess is more a way of putting it.
Mm.
So if you have a city that doesn't contain a religion, you can't get the advantage of these units. So it sort of encourages you to adopt and expand that religion if there is a pool of defenders that could help you in a time of war. Whereas the UN would allow you to do it in any nation that's part of the UN.
That sounds appropriate, both reflection of real life and in gameplay.
Mm.
Of course, it could go horribly wrong. You've got all these units that are faith-driven, and then you change religion. You're no longer part of the Apostolic Palace. All those units aren't going to be there to help you anymore.
Yeah, yeah. So that wouldn't be enough then, necessarily, to have that religion in your cities and expand it, but also to, of course, have that be your state religion.
Yeah, I mean, if you're counting on that to defend your cities, and therefore don't have to put any hammers into your own army... If you felt the need to stray away from that religion diplomatically, or you're going to go to free religion or whatever, suddenly you need a defense force. So if you've got defenders of the faith, can you have a Tenets of the Holy War where you sort of label your units under the religious banner instead of under your nation's banner when you go and fight a war?
Like a crusade?
Exactly, because right now if you do it, your nation goes to war with all those other nations. Whereas what you really want to do is have your religion go to war with that religion. And when you're no longer part of that religion, or when that crusade is over, then that diplomatic state is reset. You will have a negative diplo there, but your nation isn't individually committed to the whole fight. It's the religion that is.
Well, they had that in the mod Rise and Fall of Civilization Europe, and it worked really well there, I think. I played it a bit. You could have a crusade there, and all the Christian leaders, they would lose some units from their army, and that would become the crusading army. Whoever was the leader of the Apostolic Palace got the army, and if they conquered Jerusalem, that city became part of the civilization of the person who was in command of the Apostolic Palace.
But then again, of course, it would have to be something other than, obviously, an Apostolic Palace as we understand it, because... there is no religion concept in Civ 5 as it is known in Civ 4. It does not have the same effect. It's not on the same scale at all.
Right. It's just another diplomatic thing. If you conquer the city, it could become a city-state aligned to the religion. Or...
in reality, those crusader states, they were sort of independent from the European nations who sent their armies.
Yeah, like Malta, for example. And, of course, they're easy to conquer again at the end, because afterwards they no longer have the backing of this giant religious movement. They're just another small city with a very small defense force. Easy to take back, which is quite true in reality as well.
This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot Civ issues in the forums.
Mad Mike asks, do you think farms should be able to be built on hills? We have seen this in pics already, but do you agree with it?
Well, given that we do it in real life, yes.
Exactly.
Sure, farm on hills. Why not?
one of the commenters picks out the example that came straight to my mind when I read this, which is that, you know, the Chinese have been farming rice in rows carved into the mountainsides for hundreds of thousands of years, you know?
That long?
Hundreds or thousands, not hundreds of thousands.
Okay. I'm not sure if it's a Chinese invention or not, but it happens all over the world. South America, the Philippines, all over Asia. It's the most common thing in the world, wherever there are hills.
Yeah. The thing about hills are, it rains on them.
Yeah, exactly.
So you don't actually want to put your farm down the valley because you could just get it all washed away.
The rains just don't fall in the plains of Spain, you say?
It depends how much you've deforested the area, right?
Yeah, it depends on the environment. But if anything, I would like them to sort of highlight it more a little bit and maybe have actual terraces as graphics out and then just overlay a farm graphic over a hill graphic. But yeah, it makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah, that would be nice.
If you wanted just for some sort of gameplay differential to say that it doesn't yield the same food as, say, farm on a grassland, for instance, whether that's more or less, I would assume less from gameplay perspective. But the fact that you're not able to do that right now in Civ 4, gee, I actually hadn't really thought about it before.
It struck me whenever you could put a pasture on top of a hill, and I was like, well, why can't I build a farm here? And you get that reduced food from the hill pasture because it doesn't have that extra food bonus on it to begin with. So a farm would be the same.
Exactly. It always strikes me every time I have a chain of irrigation and I want to carry it across like hilly area and I can't. Which doesn't necessarily make sense to me.
Some of the hills start with food and some of the hills don't. One's like 2 hammers and a food and the other one's 3 hammers. What's wrong with that? Okay, some hills you can't put farms on. Fine. Some you can.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe you can't do it on a plains hill, for example, but a grassland hill you could.
Yeah, you could do that. You do want to be careful enough. Civ 4, the very early versions of it, terrain was almost random. Some hills you could do this, but some hills you couldn't. And it was just confusing what you could do when it was really unclear. So you don't want to be consistent about it. So yeah, I mean, all grassland hills can have a farm and all plains hill can't or something like that. But don't make it random.
Yeah, or if you do make it random, the thing is that in Civ 4, the yield counter is off by default. That's no good. You need to show the yield all the time if it's random. Graphically, by looking at making it look food-rich in some way.
Darker or lighter or something.
If it looks dry, you're not going to try and put a farm there, unless you can irrigate.
Yeah. But it needs to be consistent. That's the important thing.
And that would help with the chain irrigation thing that you mentioned too there, right? That way you don't have to wait for biology or whatever the Civ 5 equivalent will be.
But why would you build a farm? It only gives +1 food, while a windmill gives +1 food and extra commerce and even hammers later on.
Yeah, but you don't have windmills to begin with. So you would probably upgrade farms to windmills to end. It's essentially like saying you should be able to have windmills that don't give you extra hammers earlier on.
Yeah, I don't think we know whether or not there are windmills in Civ 5. I don't think we've seen them yet.
Much to Michael's dismay, I know.
Certainly you don't have them early on.
I love windmills. If you buy the special edition, you get a 176-page book featuring artwork from the game, an exclusive 2GB flash drive replica of Jim Rayner's dog tag, behind-the-scenes DVD containing over an hour of developer interviews. Oh, wait! That's the StarCraft II Special Edition. So what you get with the Civ 5 Special Edition is a 176-page hardcover art book, a DVD of behind-the-scenes of Firaxis, 2-disc CD soundtrack, and a 5 metal figurines based on units. What? Is this like some sort of conspiracy special editions where a union has decided this is what goes into special editions? 176 pages is the standard. That's what it has to be.
It's not so much a conspiracy if it's public knowledge. Every game has a special edition and it's pretty much the same for every game as well. That's hardly a conspiracy.
Well, this whole behind the scenes and then a CD containing the soundtrack and then 176 page of artwork, it's just too eerily similar between the two special editions. I've never seen that before. I've seen special editions before that come with some sort of gimmicky piece of prop, but it's just too similar.
You know how many special editions that are that have behind-the-scenes CDs and that have thin miniatures? I mean, so many special editions are all almost the same. Every now and again you have a weird one, like Modern Warfare 2, where you get a night vision goggles. That's kind of cool. But a lot of them, it's all the same stuff.
Yeah, I was thinking about Batman Arkham Asylum as well. Had a cool little Batarang. And...
Yeah, exactly. But those are far and few between. Most of them, it's all this sort of stuff. Behind the scenes, you get the soundtrack, you get miniatures. It's all the same sort of stuff.
Why would you pay money for this two-disc CD soundtrack thing when the entire soundtrack sits there on your hard disk anyway?
Yeah.
You've already bought it.
Yeah, and probably in MP3 format, so...
DVD behind the scenes. I don't want to be Negative Nancy here, but who cares? Is that too harsh?
Well,
if I bought this, I'm not sure I would even watch it.
Well, then this product is not marketed to a you, to your interest. There must be a market for it, otherwise it wouldn't be out there.
Right. Well, I mean, I bought Civ 4, the physical disc, and I got the fold-out tech tree and the manual, which was useless. And all this stuff seems even more useless than that. That's all. That's what I'm getting at. It's a big price jump for stuff, but you know, I wouldn't buy it.
If I recall correctly, when Civilization 4, I think it was Vanilla Civ 4, but it could have been a later one, was released in China, I believe it came with, it wasn't a figurine, it was larger than that. It was a bust or something of Warrior or something like that. And so now this is just kind of expanding on that and making it more formalized for all potential releases. But I'll tell you what, I am waiting for Civilization 5 Special Deluxe Remastered Edition.
Which has 6 figurines.
Yeah.
Why would you need to remaster something that just came out?
I didn't say when it was going to be released, Lisa.
Oh, I see. Yeah, you'll be waiting for a long time.
This special edition, really, it's basically a way to sponsor Firaxis. I mean, it costs almost nothing to produce, but you pay, $50 extra?
Yep.
I've heard on this podcast and many similar podcasts this whole get off my lawn kids argument of I want the physical media. I haven't bought a physical game in maybe 3 years since digital downloads really started, and I'm never going back. In fact, I am kind of forced to buy StarCraft II in physical form because Blizzard hasn't really got their act together and made a digital store where I can pre-order it. So that's going to be the first physical game I've bought in 3 years. And I'm not some young guy who doesn't remember the age of having something physical in my hand. I just don't need it. Don't want to store it in my space. I don't want to have to stick a CD in my drive. That era is gone. So this stuff, I guess, harkens to people who really want the physical media of some sort.
It could. I like having both. I don't like having the CD in the drive, though. I just like it as a physical copy in addition to the digital copy. And maybe it's a nostalgic thing. Maybe it's actually, oh, you know, my shelves don't look so bare anymore. Everybody loves to furnish their living accommodations with
video game boxes.
Exactly.
Come over to my house. Look at my Civilization paraphernalia.
Hey, baby.
One more turn?
Calling today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at The Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
The special edition does seem to confirm Giant Death Robot. If you look at one of the miniatures.
Yeah, it does look like a mech, doesn't it?
Yep. Don't know what else it would be.
It could actually just be an engineer. A futuristic engineer.
I'm going to go with Giant Death Robot.
I would love that. But they did confirm that the game ends in 2050, regular timeline gameplay.
Yeah, that still gives them 40 years.
That's right.
Yeah. Have you seen any Giant Death Robots in production lately?
If you look at some of the stuff coming out of Japan...
I think there's a lot of wishful thinking there still. Certainly augmented soldiers with body armor that augments their strength. That's going to happen. That's happening right now. But that's not Giant Death Robot.
Patience.
August 18th to 22nd, there's the biggest gaming convention in the world in Cologne, Germany. So this is mostly for the European listeners.
I plan on going, and based on past incarnations, there's a good chance that Firaxis will be there as well with Civ 5. It would be cool to have some kind of meetup with some Civ fans from We Play Civ, Apollon, Civnetics, whoever's there. Check out the forums. There are links in the Civ 5 general forum for Apollon, We Play Civ, and Civnetics.
You also included an embedded YouTube video of a promo which you refer to as terrible, terrible.
Yes, absolutely terrible. But it shows some video from past editions of the events. It gives you some idea if you've never been to this kind of event. It's sort of similar to an E3 or a Tokyo Game Show or something like that. But it's open to the general public. So it will be really big.
This was Polycast episode 98. I was Emperor Peter.
Do you regret coming back on the show again and so quickly after your first appearance, no less?
Yes, I do. I mean, no, of course not.
Also with you was Michael Lucas Smith.
Now, Michael, I'd have to go back and check. I don't know if you're up to 5 or 6 times guesting now. Why do you keep coming back?
I always appreciate the opportunity to come on and talk about Batman Arkham Asylum. It's a really great game. So, yeah, this is a great forum to talk about good games like Batman Arkham Asylum.
Yeah, we really should talk about that more.
Bye.
Where does Loki test?
Wouter, the last time you were on was about episode 65, so it's been a little while.
Only a little.
Do you think it needs to be 30-plus episodes again before you're back on and you're fully recovered?
No, I think it needs to be a little more than that.
Yeah, I mean, the only reason why I came back this time was because Mackie wasn't going to be on, and I was, so whatever.
Wouter agreed to come on this episode before he knew you were going to be on, Michael, so I don't know.
Bye-bye.
Daniel Quick.
Just one more turn, just one more turn, is the chant that unites us all. We'll play day and night with all our might until we win or we fall. Kudos to Enigma Code.
And Lisa.
Yes.
Goodbye.
We'll see you next time.
Echo much?
Yeah, it's a fair bit of echo or something from you there, Peter.
Hold on.
Okay, let's experiment. Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, that's an echo.
Yeah, okay.
I recognize that Canadian blah, 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 anywhere.
That might make the outtakes. Okay. It's quality podcasting right there with a capital Q.
I see what you did there. Now.
And me, Lisa Kiernel. Do I have to say something here if I did it? I could say, like, yeah.
You know what you could do? You could leave Wilder Schneider out of it.
Burned! You missed Locutus there, Lisa.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear Locutus before, so I... Okay.
That's okay.
And, Wouter Locutus.
Hello, everyone.
Oh, and that guy.
Imran lives. Imran lives.
Actually, I think we'll get to that in one of our next stories.
Is that like a hint to move on to the next story?
It sounds like it.
Yes.
And again, I kill the conversation. I help put it out of its misery. Got to move on. Okay, fine then.
But yeah, Dan the Conversation Slayer. Yeah, he didn't mention he deserved to fall for me.
Oh, Conversation Slayer. I like that.
Lada was suggesting that we would be talking about something coming up.
He said it was an intro-outro topic.
Yeah.
So...
I'm confused.
Yes. It was the special edition topic.
Ah,
okay.
Special edition.
Well, why don't we talk about it?
Sure. Why not?
Okay, go ahead.
Let's see.
Or not. I'll do it.
Hang on a second.
As Michael volunteers, I'm happy to volunteer to step aside.
So, if you buy the special edition, you get... Oh, wait, where's the page going? Too many erect, as the advertisement says. You may have to edit that out.
I'm not sure if that's accurate, but it could be.
I don't know. If it's not, I'm sure some intrepid listener will flame us.
2.5 hours.
You know, when you want quality, you gotta go with quantity. I'm gonna go with that.
If you want 2 seconds of quality, you gotta record 2.5 hours of quantity.
Record date?
July 17th, 2010.
Civilization Sound Clips, copyright Take Two Interactive.
Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.